welcome to the 19th edition of the Roots Aviation Podcast. My name is Wesley Charnock, Head of Content for Roots, and today we're going to bring you another live session from Roots Asia 2019, which took place in Cebu in the Philippines.
Hi there, I'm David Casey, I'm online editor for Roots Online, and today we've got a podcast with Alan McIntyre, who is Jetstar's Executive Manager of Commercial Planning. Alan says the airline is looking to grow in Thailand, India and Japan, and he also explains why airlines and tourism authorities should work more closely together to make Roots a success.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and don't forget we have a whole host of other interviews available on the Roots Aviation Podcast channel on iTunes and on rootsonline.com. Alan was interviewed live on stage by Nigel May, Senior Vice President for Consulting and Product Development at ASM. So, over to Nigel and Alan.
So, let's start. The first thing I want to do is just understand a little bit more about Jetstar. And it'd be great if you could just give a little bit of an overview about Jetstar, how long it's been operating, and bit about the... you've been one of the stalwarts of the long-haul low-cost.
Well, thanks, Nigel. Really great to be here. I'll try and do my best to cover for others as well. So hopefully everybody will stay in the room while I'm talking. But very nice for you to invite me. So Jetstar, I think we've been around for at least 15 years. I forget exactly. I've been there for 4 years. Jetstar is part of the Qantas Group, although it has a varied ownership structure. So we operate in Australia, 100% owned by Qantas, and we have both domestic and short-haul operations with 60 narrow-body aircraft in Australia and New Zealand and across the Tasman, and also 11 787s as well. And then we also operate in Singapore with 18 aircraft flying out of Changi and around that region in terms of narrow-bodies. We're in Japan with a narrow-body operation with 24 aircraft, finally in Vietnam with 15 aircraft. That flexes up and down at different times of the year. So I think all told, that's about 130 aircraft, of which 11 are the wide-body 787s. Mm.
And they're quite big bases that you've just mentioned there in each of those countries. So is there kind of a certain amount of critical mass that you feel that Jetstar needs to have in a country before it all?
Well, absolutely. You want to be able to sort of concentrate resources to a significant degree. I mean, there is significant growth in Japan, for example. At the moment, we have bases in Narita, which is our largest base in Japan, but also in Osaka and Nagoya as well. And then we have bases throughout Australia. Obviously, that makes for greater efficiency from an operational standpoint. And that's something we're sort of working on further to really have top quality operational resilience and top quality on-time performance.
But you don't have a minimum of, you think, I need, a base needs to have at least 3 or 4 aircraft?
Yes, we do, really. For operational efficiency and crew reasons, we really, even if you don't start off with that number straight away, we're looking at sort of at least 3 or 4 aircraft base over a fairly short period of time. So Nagoya, for example, is a fairly small base at the moment. We only opened it last year, but we'd be looking to expand that over the coming years.
Okay, now that's great. And in terms of the long haul section, or the long haul proportion of that traffic, so 11 out of 130 aircraft is long haul with the 787s. Can you just give a bit of a flavour where that operation is
sure.
flying to?
Sure. So our long haul, it's predominantly serving, or has predominantly served the outbound Australian leisure market. We are probably the most successful long haul low cost airline, I'd say, in the world in terms of how we've gone over the last several years. As I say, predominantly serving the outbound Australia market. But also, as well, Japan is an important market for us. So where do we fly? We fly to Bali a lot. Australians love going to Bali. I hadn't realised until I moved to Australia just how much Australians love going to Bali, but they certainly do. We fly, as I say, to Osaka and Narita. And that's probably about a 50-50 split inbound-outbound. We're also flying to Thailand. We launched Vietnam 2 years ago now. So we operate there out of Sydney and Melbourne. We're flying to Hawaii, which is our longest legs from Melbourne and Sydney. We fly to Singapore. Have I missed any? That's the bulk of the network, I think.
Bangkok? You mentioned Bangkok.
I think I mentioned Bangkok. Bangkok and Phuket. Yeah, Phuket.
So it's concentrated in effectively five countries that the concentration is in. And let's talk a little bit about the product so this is long haul low cost product, but your configuration is does have a premium product, doesn't it?
Yeah, so we have 335 seats on the 787s, of which 21 are in the front cabin. It's basically we have economy and business cabin. The business cabin is a 38 seat pitch. I suppose it's more akin in many respects to premium economy, which is suitable for the leisure market, leisure customers that we're flying. So we have 21 seats there, and then the remaining 314 in economy. You have in-flight entertainment in all the seats. Obviously, as per a low-cost airline, it's an unbundled product, so you can choose to have the IFE for $9.50. You can choose what food you have. So yes, it's the typical unbundled product, but what that does allow us to do is to offer some extremely sharp fares. So, for example, I was just having a look this morning. You can fly from Melbourne to Bali for $189. You can go to Hawaii for $249. That's an 11-hour sector for $249. So, you know, this is what we're about. It's about providing opportunities for travel that otherwise people just couldn't do, wouldn't do.
And what about the higher end of those fares? Where do they stretch up to?
They're a little bit more.
Okay, we'll leave it at that then.
They're obviously still very reasonable fares throughout. I mean, obviously in peak periods you'll be paying more, but you can choose to go and buy a sail fare for those sorts of amounts. And so it's remarkable how we've been able to provide holiday options for people that otherwise wouldn't be. Going to Hawaii, wouldn't be going to Thailand, or wouldn't be coming from Japan to Australia. Or, for example, I mean, when we first started flying Australia to Japan, I don't think skiing in Japan was a major thing for the Australian market, and it now is. You know, Australians fly all the way to Japan to go skiing now, and it's amazing how we've been able to stimulate that through our low fares.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of stimulation rates, can you give some sort of flavour on what you would expect a normal stimulation rate to be, or what that range is?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it varies, but I mean, we're seeing stimulation rates of well over 70%, over 100% sometimes. So we have a significant stimulation rate that's in essence what we're about, what we're looking for when we're adding new routes. You know, we'll look at what the fares are in the market. Or in the indirect market, or sometimes there really isn't that much of a market, and we can understand what sort of stimulation we should be able to bring to the market.
Okay, so we're going to come on later on to what the airports can offer, but just to finish off the product piece, what sort of on the ground product do we offer? So in terms of lounges, do they get access to the Qantas lounges if you buy a premium ticket, or? Is there anything that?
And we're not sort of big into the access to lounges. Obviously, Qantas Frequent Flyer members can access depending on their status and others as well. But I think the main thing that we're looking for is efficiency through the airport. So we're a big advocate of the use of new technology and online check-in. And I suppose what we're saying to airports is that we want to work with you in terms of how we can get our passengers through the airports quickly and then into your shops, because leisure passengers will arrive at the airport much earlier, and they want to spend. When you're going on a sort of not once in a lifetime, but certainly once in a year, maybe once in 2 year kind of trip at least. People, the whole holiday experience starts at the airport, and we want to work with the airports on getting check-in out of the way quickly and efficiently, getting through security quickly, and then there's a lot of time to be able to spend. That's when the holiday really starts, and we really are providing value to the airports in terms of those people who will spend significant amounts in the shops at airports.
And you don't mind that if they're not spending on your airport?
Well, we want them to spend there as well, but there's only we don't sell everything that on board that the airports are able to sell, and people are very keen, as I say, to start their holiday experience.
Yeah. Right, let's just go back to the numbers a little bit, and you mentioned about stimulation rates, and for the airports and destinations that are out there, that you often think about what are the market conditions that you'll be looking at to enter into a new market. So, you know, is there a minimum market size, or do you look at the indirect traffic flows that are currently on a particular route? You know, what do you expect there to be currently?
Well, we'll certainly look at indirect flows as a guide, I suppose, and as something where we can offer something additional, like any airline would with a new service and with a point to point. But we'll also look at the fares that there are in the market. We'll look at where people are travelling at the moment and whether we can provide an alternative destination. And we'll base that partly on history as well, as to what we can stimulate further. If we feel that the market is, or maybe it's overpriced, or maybe it's serving a primarily business market, but there is a considerable latent leisure market there that we can divert. I mean, I think one of the things is, increasingly, what we're looking at now is the potential for Asia inbound. As I said, we've grown up quite a lot with serving Australia outbound, and we've done that very, I think, pretty successfully. But there is big growth to be had in Asia. Asia to Australia is due to grow at twice the speed of other international markets. And Australia is a very popular destination, or a very, if you like, aspirational destination from the surveys we've done. It comes in the top sort of 3 to 4 places, particularly for long haul, that people want to go to in Asia. And we want to be a part of that. And so, yes, we'll look at indirect flows, but we'll also look at the potential, partly based on our Japan experience in particular, as to what the fares are maybe in the market, but the potential for people who want to go to Australia, and to be able to serve them with the appropriate fares. And, you know, we've been surprised to some extent by Vietnam, which we saw as very much a outbound Australian market, which it still predominantly is for us, but the numbers of inbound Vietnamese is certainly higher than we had expected, yes.
Now, that's fascinating. And in terms of... You touched upon that you've got a premium product, and I noticed that it sort of is shown as J. And you mentioned earlier that you called it a business class product, but you mentioned earlier to me you're not targeting the business market, are you?
No, I mean it's premium leisure, and I don't want to be totally open about that, because we don't want any people, when they're paying out of their own wallets, are looking for something that's maybe it's better, but flat beds cost a lot.
Yeah.
And so we think that's an appropriate product for people who are travelling on premium leisure, and we get very good feedback from that.
Yeah. And when you're looking at these new markets, do you take into account any connecting traffic, given your size of your network in Australia?
Absolutely we do. I think there's got to be a significant point-to-point, but we can feed in, particularly if it's inbound, we can feed in through all sorts of points in Australia, because we have a very extensive network domestically. So whether you're flying into Melbourne or Sydney or Gold Coast or Brisbane or Cairns as a first point, then we can connect people around. And I think a lot of people, you know, if they're coming from Asia, they want to travel around Australia. It's a long, almost like wherever you're coming from, it's a long way to go to Australia. Yeah. And so you want to see the you want to see the reef, you want to see the rock, and you want to see the Opera House. I think that's the that's the traditional sort of thing. So people want to travel around, and we can provide all of that with our domestic network.
Yeah. But on those routes, you won't necessarily think, okay, there's going to be 10% connecting flow and attribute some of that revenue to that route. What you always look at it from a point-to-point basis, and that's...
We'll look at it primarily from a point-to-point basis. I mean, we have... in a way, it's the icing on the cake of what we actually then capture in terms of domestic traffic as well. But it's the business case will primarily be on the point-to-point.
And the final question, just on terms of market conditions, is it right that you'll look at a service in maybe 3 a week, 4 a week to begin with, and scaling that up, or are you happy to leave it at a 3 or 4 week weekly service?
Well, we prefer to have it more often. I think from an operational robustness perspective, it's better if we can get towards or at daily. Now, we started Vietnam at various, like between 6 and 7 a week between Melbourne and some is on Melbourne, some is on Sydney. But we went in from day one with 6 or 7 a week. So that was quite a big entry into the market. There will be others that will start at maybe three a week. But we prefer to increase that because from an efficiency perspective, it's better.
It's got to be daily.
It's better for us, and the nearer you can get towards daily or more. I mean, we do Melbourne Bali double daily, and so we'd like to increase further to at least daily if we can. But there'll be some markets we would accept at a sub daily.
Okay. So when the airports are out there, they need to be looking at those stimulation rates of 70% to 100% and looking to see whether they can ultimately show a growth in a market where you can get to daily.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the only caveat to that is I would say it's a bit like with Vietnam, is particularly we want to fly to, it might not be always daily from that city in Australia. There's several places we could fly to, you know, Melbourne, Brisbane, Sydney, so it might be 3 or 4 a week for one and another 3 or 4 a week for another. So it depends on the market. But I think the main thing is that we want to develop considerable presence at both ends of the route. So if we're flying into Asia, we want to develop our presence, and it might be that we fly 3 or 4 places in Australia, which obviously is efficient from an operational and also from a commercial and marketing perspective. Mm. And you know, from a crewing perspective, you can rotate crew around. I'd like airports to look at it in that way, that it's not just a Melbourne service. It might be 3 or 4 places in Australia that we'd look to expand to.
Okay, so they should be looking at the individual routes within Australia as future
growth points. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've looked at the market conditions. What about the competition? How does that feature? Are you more comfortable with competing against some carriers more so than others? Do you look at the...
We welcome all competition, Nigel. I mean, we have to have a very good cost position for this, because as I talked about the stimulation factor, that's how it works. So, you know, if we feel that fares are high in the market, then obviously that's somewhere where we can add value to that market and to passengers. But, you know, some of our markets are more niche. Some of them are, maybe we're the main low-cost player in the market, and we can add value in that way. You know, other markets, we're the only player there, and we're the most appropriate player because full-service carriers won't want to operate some of those routes. And so that's what I say again. You know, we are about creating markets either on our own or passengers who would not otherwise travel on that market, even if the full-service carrier is there. So we can sit, I think, fairly comfortably, and airports should understand this, we can sit comfortably alongside full-service carriers without sort of stealing passengers from them. or on our own, but it's very much about growth of new passengers rather than just sort of redistributing passengers across the airlines.
Yeah, because I suppose on the markets where you've got competition like Bangkok and TG, or with Ho Chi Minh City with Vietnam, those carriers haven't come off the route and they've remained, and any traffic that you might have cannibalised, there's been more that's been stimulated on top of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I talked about the stimulation factor earlier. Yeah. We're not cannibalising. We are creating new markets.
And competed against the Malindos or the Lion Airs on the Bali route. That's demonstrated that as long as the market size is big enough, you can compete. You can sit comfortably with another low cost carrier on those markets.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have a very strong brand, especially in the Australian market, and we can. We're confident we can compete effectively, and we have a good cost base to do that.
Okay. Now, looking at future markets, probably we've looked at the market conditions, the competition, etc. So when you now look at that across all of Asia, and you mentioned that you want to look at new Asia markets coming into Australia. So where's next? Where are the next countries that you're looking at are growing into?
Well, quite a significant number of potentials, which is good for us, and there's always only so much capacity we can throw at it. I mean, obviously, we'd like to grow Japan more. It's a very important market, given we've also got a domestic airline in Japan as well. So I think there's potential for further growth there. But really, across Asia, if we can get there is demand coming into the market over the next several years. So it's really working with airports and tourist boards and governments to make sure that we can get the right cost base. So, whether it's Taiwan, Korea, India, growth in Thailand, all of these markets have significant growth potential. But we do need to make sure that we work in partnership with airports to unlock that potential as well.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that airport support then that you mentioned, and how you want to work with an airport. What are you looking for? What are the big things in terms of market support and operational support?
Well, I think probably a few things. First of all, surprises are not great in terms of sort of sudden cost shocks, which can impact demand. But I suppose most importantly, we are putting a very expensive asset into the market, and then we are stimulating that market, which over the first sort of 3 years is a ramp up, and we need airports to work with us and support us on that, because we're not sort of just generally, it's nice if you can, but capturing the market from day one. That has to ramp up over time, so we do need financial support to help us to do that, which encourages us to put our assets into that market versus another market. And I suppose in the longer term, it also encourages us to get fleet so that we're not having to suffer losses in the early years. So we do need airports. We're making a big financial, kind of bet, and we need airports to work with us on that. So that's certainly one thing.
And the length of the agreement? Three?
Well, certainly three years as a ramp-up period. But also beyond that, if we're continuing to offer, as we need to, $249 to Hawaii, $189 to Bali, we need to make sure that there is an appropriate cost base ongoing from the airport and without cost shocks. As I said earlier, we're providing something very useful in terms of passengers through the airport who want to spend in the shops. We run 90% load factors on a 335-seater aircraft, so there's a lot of people coming in that we can provide to the airport. We just need that help coming back to in partnership, continue to stimulate demand. I think the other thing that is really important is competitiveness in the ground handler front. Because obviously that's a significant part of our cost as well. So airports that are able to get more competitive ground handling that's really important.
And what about taxation from governments in terms of...
Well, I suppose that's what I mean in terms of shocks. You know, there was a little bit of... I think there's a little bit around, Asia or the world at the moment around this is a good thing to tax. And our customers are... there's great price elasticity. And, you know, you impose a tax and, if we... You can't pass it on. People will stop flying. They are very elastic, and so the customers that we're putting on our aircraft will, if the prices are low, will travel more, and they'll travel more often, which is good for us, and it's good for airports, and it's good for the customer. And if we start to sort of see that as just a way to tax more, that's actually going to hurt everybody in the long run, because it means that we won't be able to invest in new fleet and new services, whereas if we can capture together the huge demand that there is coming from Asia over the next years, particularly in leisure, as I say, 80% of the growth in Asia is going to be leisure, and it's carriers like Jetstar that are really suited for a lot of that. And if we can avoid that big increases in taxation that we're seeing a little bit at the moment, that'll help everybody in terms of capturing that demand appropriately. The other thing that I suppose we're looking for from airports, as I say, is efficiency in terms of really sort of sweating the assets and using technology. I talked earlier about using technology for check-in and through security, because that's efficient for us in terms of our cost base. It's efficient for the airports in terms of their cost base, and it gets people airside where they want to be.
Mm-hmm. Just on the price elasticity piece, do you find that the long-haul passengers are, should we say, less, more inelastic in that they'll absorb that price increase a lot more so than the short-haul?
No.
Or is there no difference whatsoever?
There's really very little difference. I mean, I think the thing is, it's a big outlay. Even travelling on Jetstar, because, you know, you're travelling on Jetstar and then you're probably going maybe on a 2-week holiday. It's a big outlay, particularly a long haul holiday. And so if you're starting to add more to that, people will stay at home or they'll travel short haul, and so they won't come. It's a misnomer, both short haul and long haul, to say that you can just sort of, you know, it's only $10. If it was, quite frankly, if it was as simple as that, because I run revenue management as well, I'd put $10 on the price and make a bit more money. But I can't, because it kills demand.
Yes.
It's something that I really must emphasise, that what seems like, well, it's only $10, it's only $15, will really restrict demand. People won't travel or won't travel as often. Takes a lot for people to travel long haul, and that's why I think, you know, the Jetstar has been fairly uniquely successful on long haul low cost. It's a very tough game, long haul low cost, and there's a lot of people who haven't done so well, and we have, and we want to continue to do that and continue to develop that, but we need to do that in partnership.
Is there, just to finish the support side of it, and then I'm going to ask you, are there differences between short and long haul? That support, is it a combination of airport fees, marketing support, or have some countries and airports, have they successfully introduced the revenue guarantees type deals and those more complex support structures?
Yeah, I mean, they'll come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. And, you know, we'd love a revenue guarantee, but I think Well, one thing I would say is we know how to fill our planes. So we want to be able to market in the way and the most efficient way that we can market. What we do need support from in some way is the support, particularly in the early years financially, to mean that we're not making significant losses as we develop the market. We can though go out and market using particularly our own ways to market that work. Mm. So it's almost like, to some extent, let us do the marketing And then, but then we need support to be able to put that asset there in the first place.
You don't need to be tied into complex joint marketing deals where or marketing in a particular way. You want the money to be able to market it, but you'll do it yourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously we need to market it. But I mean, one of the things we do have, you know, we have a, you know, we have a database, particularly in Australia, of millions of names, and you know we can market to that database, and we can market successfully in other ways. We know what works. We know how to fill the planes, but we do need support financially to underwrite putting the asset in.
And do you ever figure in your head that any new route will take $500,000, $1 million to start a new route, or does it depend?
Kind of depends.
If you're adding a route in Japan, it's going to be.
I'd say over a 3-year period, it's in the millions.
Yeah.
But obviously, we'd like to sit down with airports and discuss that, and with tourist boards. And it's most successful if you've got an airline, airport, and often a tourist board relationship coming together. And you know, we've worked in that way in a number of different places, and it's worked well, and everybody's sort of gunning towards the same goal.
Okay. Does the support differ between long and short haul, or not really? Same process, same. You know, the numbers are maybe slightly bigger in terms of your investment, but
I think that general principle held true when I worked for EasyJet as well. Yeah. So it's kind of, it's probably particularly true on long haul because we're creating new markets, perhaps even more in long haul.
Is that just because the short haul routes have tended to be done and they've already
to
been
to some extent? We'd still do that in short, but I think long haul is probably even more the case, and that's what we've successfully done.
Okay, right. I've got 2 minutes of questions. I'm going to open it up to the floor. So, gosh, the hands are going up already, and I had more questions to ask. Let me take the questions from the floor now, then, and then we'll come to them. So let's go down here first of all. Oh, let's go to Stephen first.
Hi, Stephen from Hong Kong Express.
Hi.
Curious about, you've said that you're more successful than other long-haul low-cost. Is that something about management, or is that a geography issue?
Well, I'd obviously say it's management, but...
good question.
Sure, geography has probably helped us, but I guess it's recognizing what works for the geography that you're in. So we've got a powerful brand in Australia that we've used and focused on outbound leisure. We've been very focused on that, and that's worked well. And then we've, as I say, with Japan, we've developed that market to some extent, working off the back of the brand now that we've got in Japan as well, so that the brand, the domestic and the international. Works together well. I think we're obviously very focused on cost. Most of our routes are sort of 6 to 11 hour time frame. That seems to be a bit of a sweet spot. So I guess we're sort of trying to replicate the things that work well, where we're to some extent creating a niche market, and we focus on. We focus on not too many markets, but where we can actually make a difference, where we see fares that are too high in the market, or fares that are too high for leisure passengers to be able to benefit, then we can come in and provide something different to the customer. I think maybe, you know, some low costs, and I don't track it that closely, but maybe some low costs have tried to move on to markets where. They're not really adding anything particularly different from what full service carriers are able to offer as well. I'd like to think that we're, in most cases, are actually offering something that will be of added benefit to customers.
It's quite interesting. I mean, it's a great question. You seem to have developed quite sensibly over the years. And the fact that it's still only five country markets that you're that you're in, if you look compared with some of the European carriers that have done long-haul low-cost, they've probably scattered too thinly and gone tried to tackle a number of different markets over a number of time, lots of different geographies, and that hasn't always seemed to have delivered the same sort of results that you've had. And you have been operating for 15 years, and you've been profitable from pretty much day one. So,
yeah, I mean, to be honest, I would like to be even more focused. And I was talking to you earlier about the increase towards daily. I think that helps to make the robustness of our network higher, the resilience of the as well as the cost base, but also the resilience of the network higher. If we're more focused, we can focus our engineering resources perhaps in a geographical area. Yeah. Whereas if you scatter too much, then your operational resilience can fall down as well.
Yeah. Okay, great. We've got another question here. Yeah. I'll give you a name and company.
Yeah. I'm Shalimar Tamano. I'm the regional director of the Department of Tourism in Cebu and Bohol and the rest of the region. You mentioned a few times that you work together with airports and tourism boards. And I'm interested because in Cebu, we work closely with MCIA and GMR, who operates the airport. So I'm wondering if what do you mean when you work with them? How close do you work with them? We're interested if our working relationship with the airport and the operator is good enough, or what do you expect with the tourism boards in the cities you operate with?
Well, I think the sort of examples I'm talking about is where all three sort of sides, come together, work out what is needed in the market. Obviously, we'll have our own ideas. We'll work out what the business case looks like. We'll talk about what financial support we would need. We'll need to identify, together with the tourist boards, what is required for the market in terms of the customers, really who the customers are. And they can, sometimes, particularly, I suppose, if we're going more and more into inbound Australia, we are stretching ourselves a little bit more in terms of understanding of the marketplace. So, maybe I'm contradicting myself slightly where I said we know how to fill our planes. We do, but I think when we're going into inbound Asia, we'll be looking for guidance, at least, from tourists or from the local area. If it's inbound into Australia, at any rate, we'd be looking for the airports to guide us in terms of the nature of the local market. And if it's tourist boards that were for ex-Australia, we'd be looking to work with them as well in terms of understanding how we what the essence is of that we can actually market back into Australia. So I think it's both a financial and a knowledge sharing activity that we do come together with airports and tourist boards to set the route up and to operate it over the initial years.
I mean, the tourist boards always have that experience of not just the tourism, the product, but understanding more about the customers and the visitation into a marketplace. So I suppose that's where you're talking about that knowledge. That's what you're expecting them to bring to it. How much do you look into the actual product side of it? Do you look at what tours are on offer, what the people are going to actually do
Absolutely, but that's what I mean in terms of understanding from the tourist board, tourist boards, what is the essence of this destination? And also we want to be able to put that content, onto our website and to our database of customers so that, because, it's very much now about consideration set to start off with messing with my mic. It's the consideration set to get people to understand from all these places that they might go to, why go to Cebu, for example, and we're talking to all of these customers that we've got in our database in particular, and we can start to develop that consideration set, and then as you narrow that down through the booking journey, and we can, you know, we can potentially bundle up product as well through our own distribution sources that you can you can add. It's not just the flight. It's you know, we as an airline want to add more content to what we're selling, whether it's hotels, car hire, and other things. And so over time, we'd be looking to sort of develop content which the tourist boards and other interested parties can guide us on.
To what extent do you package? So I assume a consumer can book a hotel, book a car hire, but you don't do Jetstar holidays.
Well, we do do Jetstar holidays, but that's an area that we're looking to expand further on. We think that with our brand, particularly in Australia, we think that we should be able to package more. Yeah. You know, all these people are buying our flights, but maybe sometimes they're going to other places to actually buy other, whether it's tours, whether it's accommodation or whatever. We think we could do much more in that field, and we'd be happy to work with all sorts of providers to develop that. And it is something strategically that Jetstar wants to do more of.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. It's not a Jetstar holiday package in terms of that you would have a Jetstar Holidays hotel or like a TUI product in the UK. But
we are in that game, but we think there's a lot further we can go. I think when I was at EasyJet, I was running EasyJet Holidays as well, and the sort of airlines have perhaps not that successfully developed the package market, with a few exceptions of the package offering, something that certainly strategically Jetstar would like to do more of.
Interesting. Okay. Are there any other further questions? I've got a couple more here whilst you think of them. So I did want to know, we've got a couple of minutes left. What are there routes that have failed and why?
All before my time. No. I'm told we used to fly Singapore-Beijing. It obviously didn't work because we don't fly Singapore-Beijing now. I suppose the main point to say there is strategically across the group, what we're particularly into in terms of long-haul low-cost at this moment, and some of the other areas may well develop further, but we're particularly focused on outbound Australia leisure and developing further into the inbound Asia market as the demand grows inbound into Australia. That's probably where our focus primarily is in terms of long-haul. New technologies are developing in terms of aircraft capability, and that will allow some of our Asian carriers, even with narrow body, to fly further. So Jetstar Japan may well fly further in time to come, but at the moment it's predominantly that, and we want to be really focused on that area.
And because you were talking a little bit earlier about the A320neos coming into the fleet. 321 neos that are coming into the fleet. So that's going to free up a little bit of capacity to use elsewhere.
Yeah, so the 321neo is capable of flying to Bali, for example. So we may start to put some of those onto Bali, which will allow us to redirect some 787s onto other routes. So we see this as a growth opportunity for us, kind of what I'm talking about here today. There is significant growth in this market. It's growing, as I say, very quickly, and we want to be a part of that. And we see opportunities there if we can get it right, and if we can work with other people to make sure the cost base is there to get it right.
Okay. And my final kind of question on this is: have there been any routes that have surprised you in terms of performance and why? And
I probably already said a couple. Vietnam surprised me in terms of the inbound into Australia; it was higher than we thought. I think Bali continues to surprise me in terms of its resilience. You can have a volcano one week and it bounces back. People still want to go to Bali very, very quickly, which is great. Mm. So those are probably two that in my time at Jetstar have surprised me to some extent. I think those are probably the biggest surprises.
Okay. So if there's no further questions from the floor, I've got my final question is, Arsenal or United higher in the league?
Oh, definitely Arsenal.
We'll see how that pans out. I'll have £5 on United.
Okay.
I'll
do so, five Australian dollars.
So thank you very much, Alan McIntyre. It's been brilliant. It's got a real insight into Jetstar. Got a real... You're one of the airlines that has made long-haul, low-cost work over the last 15 years. You've done it profitably. You've managed to dispel all the theories that long-haul, low-cost won't work. And I think that's a credit to probably not just your geography, but also your management team as well. So it's been very insightful to understand how you've done that. So
all right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the podcast. Don't forget about some of the other podcasts we've got on iTunes and Roots Online, including Javier Suarez from Canada Jetlines and Michael Shao from Cebu Pacific.